listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, February 1st, and it's cold outside, or at least it feels cold to me. Our high today is expected to reach 21 degrees and a low tonight of 7. The sun is due to set at 5 o'clock, and today we're going to have 55 more minutes of sunshine than we did a month ago today on New Year's Day. So that's kind of exciting. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with best-selling Vermont author Chris Bojalian. Chris is my first return guest. I spoke with him in 2008 about his novel Skeletons at the Feast. This week, Chris and I discussed his latest book, Secrets of Eden, available in stores tomorrow. Chris Bojalian is the author of 13 books. His other novels include the New York Times bestsellers Skeletons at the Feast, which I just mentioned, The Double Bind, Before You Know Kindness, The Law of Similars, and Midwives. He won the New England Book Award in 2002, and his novel Midwives was a number one New York Times bestseller, a selection of Oprah's Book Club, a Publisher's Weekly Best Book, and a New England Booksellers Association Discovery Pick. His work has been translated into over 25 languages and twice made into movies, Midwives and Past the Bleachers. He has written for a wide variety of magazines, including Cosmopolitan, Reader's Digest, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and has been a Sunday columnist for Gannett's Burlington Free Press since 1992. Chris graduated from Amherst College and lives in Vermont with his wife, the artist Victoria Bleuer, and daughter. His latest book, Secrets of Eden, focuses on the issue of domestic violence. It is the first of his novels to emerge from reader responses to one of his previous books. The Double Bind also concerns violence against women, and the origins of Secrets of Eden came in part when women who had read The Double Bind spoke to Chris about their experiences as victims. If you heard my first interview with Chris Bojalian, you may recall my saying that when he moved to Vermont over 20 years ago, his first job was as an account executive with Sandage Advertising and Marketing in Burlington, at which I was also employed, and we worked together for roughly 2 years in an office building that now houses WOMMLP 105.9 FM, The Radiator. And as I stand here speaking to you now, I am reminded of a time when this room was Chris's office, and I kind of like that coincidence. When I spoke to Chris earlier this week, I asked him what he might say in describing Secrets of Eden for someone who has not read the book.
Secrets of Eden is a literary thriller in the tradition of Midwives and The Double Bind. It's about a domestic abuse murder-suicide in a small New England village with a twist. It has four narrators, a Baptist minister who baptizes Alice Hayward on the very day she will die. There's Catherine Benincasa, the state's attorney who's investigating what she believes is a double homicide. There's the couple's 15-year-old daughter, who's now an orphan, who's at a Frey concert in Albany when her parents die. And there's a best-selling self-help guru who writes books about the angels among us and may or may not be a total lunatic.
Very good. What was the inspiration for the book? There's so many different aspects to it, so I was curious.
Yeah. Some books have a very long gestation period, and Secrets of Eden is one of them. Secrets of Eden had its origins way back in 1997, I was researching the novel that would become The Law of Similars, and I was at the Edward J. Costello Courthouse in Burlington, Vermont. I was interviewing a victim's rights advocate, a woman who counsels victims of violent crime. And as we were chatting, she reached into a manila folder, and she tossed onto the table between us two Polaroid photographs of head indentations in sheetrock. I can remember thinking at the time, how hard must you shove someone's head to leave an indentation in sheetrock? She told me these photographs involved one of her clients, and they were part of an ongoing investigation. I would only learn weeks later it was a murder investigation. And I never stopped thinking about those photographs. You won't see them in The Law of Similars, you won't see them in any books since then. But I never stopped thinking about them. In 2007, I published The Double Bind. Mm-hmm. And The Double Bind begins with a violent sexual assault on a 26-year-old female social worker. And in the months after the book was published, I heard from women across the country in California, Oregon, Washington, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, who all wanted to know the same thing. How had I heard their story? Hmm. Because the attack on my social worker, Laurel Esterbrook, in The Double Bind, felt precisely like what they had endured. And of course, I hadn't met any of them. But it drove home the point that sexual violence and domestic abuse are absolutely epidemic in this country. And I thought again of those photographs I'd seen, the head indentations in sheetrock, and I was off and running on the book that would become Secrets of Eden, and indeed, those photographs finally appear in one of my books.
Mm-hmm. One of the aspects of this book, the domestic violence, is the background is given to us through lots of different stories about how George Hayward treated his wife, Alice. And there was just such a sense of everything wrong, everything horrible. It just made me cringe inside thinking about this. And I was thinking that you're familiar in some way, I suppose we all are, familiar in some way with someone who manipulates the people around him or her through intimidation. Was that something you had to do a lot of research on, or is that something that kind of came naturally for you to write?
I'm happy to report that I am not naturally intimidating.
Not you.
No. I did research this book in the same way that I research all my books, and I did spend time interviewing survivors of domestic abuse, talking to them about what they'd endured. And I interviewed victims' rights advocates. You'll see some of those names in the acknowledgments. People like a wonderful victims' rights advocate in rural Vermont, the state's assistant attorney general, the state's chief medical examiner. They all gave me information that was profoundly important for the construction of these characters. And then, of course, a lot of it just comes from my imagination. What is sort of the worst thing you can imagine in this sort of relationship? And it was interesting to compare the violence that George Hayward inflicts upon Alice Hayward in a marriage to the violence that the anonymous assailants, they're anonymous at the start of the book, wreak upon poor Laurel Esterbrook in The Double Bind. The Double Bind is about sort of a random sexual attack. A woman's bicycling on a dirt road, and two men attack her. In Secrets of Eden, Alice Hayward is in what looks to all the world like a reasonably happy marriage. But behind the door, the stuff that she is enduring is degrading and manipulative and scary and deeply disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You already mentioned that the book is written from four points of view, and I enjoyed each point of view, as opposed to sometimes you read books and as soon as you go to switch to the next point of view, you're a little disappointed because you have to start all over again. I thought these four went very well together to tell the story. Were these the right characters for you from the start, or did you initially try to include any other narrators? I'm thinking specifically about Alice herself, or maybe Ginny.
Ginny being Alice's good friend.
Right.
Sure. Well, I like to believe that Alice speaks to us a bit from the grave through her diary. And I think that's one of the reasons why Alice has a diary. It isn't simply a plot mechanism. It's so that she does have a voice. She does have a chance to speak her piece. When I began this book, I was only envisioning two narrators. Mm-hmm. Somebody outside the marriage and somebody inside the house.
Okay.
Stephen Drew, the minister who baptizes Alice on the day she died, would be the person giving us the outsider's view of what it looks like. And then the couple's 15-year-old daughter, Katie Hayward, would be providing us the inside view of the marriage. What's really going on? And make no mistake, domestic abuse has a huge effect on children, too. A huge effect. But when I started writing the book, I was looking for a counterfoil to Stephen Drew's intellectual cynicism. And I glommed onto the notion of a best-selling self-help author who's got a kindergarten-like faith, a kindergarten-like spirituality. She really believes in angels with wings. And that, of course, is Heather Laurent, who will become Stephen's lover. And I had a great time creating Heather Laurent. It's really fun to write from the perspective of a person who writes best-selling books about angels. I had fun writing her book.
I thought you probably did.
I had fun writing her book, Angels and Auroscapes.
Yeah.
And she's a counterfoil to Stephen Drew. And so she was the third narrator. And then I had anticipated the need for another narrator. But what happened was I was having lunch with a woman named Lauren Bowerman, who's an assistant attorney general in Vermont. Lauren, she's a great friend. She helped with the construction of midwives. She helped with the construction of the law of similars. And so now we were chatting about this issue, and she was explaining to me the notion in forensics, when you're looking at a gun in an investigation, of blowback. And I said, well, what do you mean by blowback? And she smiled and said, well, you know, how much of the bastard's brains are up the gun barrel? Or in other words, how close is the gun barrel to the skull when the trigger is pulled? And I loved everything about that sentence. How much of the bastard's brains are up the gun barrel? I loved the alliteration. I loved the rhythm. And I loved the sort of toughness, because as a state's attorney or an assistant attorney general, Lauren sees a ton of horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. So I decided, you've got to have a state's attorney in this book. I've had state's attorneys and midwives, and I've had them in the Law of Similars and probably in other books if I were to think about it. And thought, why not one more?
But that must have changed the plot incredibly, because so much of the plot is Catherine Benincasa's point of view and what she comes to believe.
It did change the book.
Yeah.
It did change the book. I think it made it better, not simply because I think Catherine is a scream. I think her voice is an absolute scream. But I think it made it more of a page-turner. It made it less a rumination on guilt and grief. You still have that sense of secrets, hence the title, but I hope it gives the book an interesting kind of momentum. You begin with Stephen, and I think your opinion changes of Stephen a lot in the course of the narrative, and then you get to Catherine, and I think Catherine is in some ways her own sort of novella within the book, because so much of her is plot, 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 just moving the book forward.
Right. One thing that I really loved about these four narrators is each one gives the reader his or her opinion of the next before we get to the next. And so we're a little bit biased before we start that next narration, which is an interesting thing as a reader. You already feel like you know this person, then all of a sudden, well, wait a minute, this is a little different than I was expecting.
Yeah. Thank you for noticing that. Indeed, Stephen has a real, you know, he's got very specific opinions about Catherine, and Catherine has got real opinions. You know, Catherine is firmly convinced that Heather Laurent is an absolute lunatic.
Right.
And might be involved in the death of George and Alice Hayward. And so then when you start reading Heather's perspective, I think some readers will be unprepared for the fact that she's smart, she's charismatic, she's interesting. Her story, in some ways, is very poignant. I think when Heather is telling you about what she endured as a child and the Edward Albee-esque Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf's lifestyle that marked her parents' marriage, those are some of my favorite scenes in the book.
Mm-hmm.
They're wrenching, but I'm fascinated when she's talking about her childhood and those drunken Christmas Eves she witnessed as a little girl, and as she puts it in part of her narrative, the disturbing place where adult sexuality and violence sometimes meet.
And she has a sister, and the two of them have witnessed some horrible things in their parents' home.
Yep, she and Amanda have witnessed some horrible things. And Heather and Amanda have turned out very differently. Heather is very, very optimistic. She's got this great faith in angels. She feels protected. She lives in a killer loft in downtown Manhattan. The loft she refers to as, you know, the loft the angels built, which is sort of her own tongue-in-cheek way of thinking about her book's incredibly unexpected success. And then there's her sister, Amanda, who lives with an ex-drug addict who's absolutely uninterested in the outside world, and the two of them live in a log cabin in the middle of the Adirondacks while he carves really scary statues of birds of prey. And Amanda is every bit as cynical and jaded as Heather is optimistic.
Well, before we talk any more, would you mind reading from the book?
Not at all.
This is Chris Bojalian reading from Secrets of Eden, which is published by Shea Earhart. And when does it come out, Chris?
The book goes on sale February 2.
Okay.
This is the opening of the novel. This is the first of the four narrators, Steve and Drew. As a minister, I rarely found the entirety of a Sunday service depressing. But some mornings, disease and despair seemed to permeate the congregation like floodwaters in sandbags. And the only people who stood during the moment when we shared our joys and concerns were those souls who were intimately acquainted with nursing homes, ICUs, and the nearby hospice. Concerns invariably outnumbered joys, but there were some Sundays that were absolute routs. And it would seem that the only people rising up in their pews to speak needed Prozac considerably more than they needed prayer, or, yes, than they needed me. On those sorts of Sundays, whenever someone would stand and ask for prayers for something relatively minor, a promotion, traveling mercies, a broken leg that surely would mend, I would find myself thinking as I stood in the pulpit, "Get a spine, you bloody ingrate! Buck up! That lady behind you is about to lose her husband to pancreatic cancer, and you're whining about your difficult boss? Oh, please." I never said that sort of thing aloud, but I think that's only because I'm from a particularly mannered suburb of New York City, and so my family has to be drunk to be cutting. I did love my congregation, but I also knew that I had an inordinate number of whiners.
Thank you. That's great. That's a great beginning. You do get a certain sense of who he is, although I think a lot of what the opening gives the reader is questions, you know, because he's kind of a conflicted fellow.
He's kind of a conflicted fellow, and the literary term, of course, for somebody like Stephen Drew is an unreliable narrator. How much is what he is telling us true, and how much of it is false, and how much is he perhaps misleading even himself?
Right. Yeah, and he suspects that too, because he's got so much guilt and so much regret about his congregant, who he baptized, Alice Hayward, and his friendship with her. I found myself wondering as I read this book if it would end with the sort of relief of Stephen being declared innocent in some dramatic courtroom moment, a la presumed innocent, or with the guilty thrill of his being convicted, because Catherine Benincasa does at some point start to suspect that he may have been involved in these deaths.
Yep.
And in the end, this is not a courtroom drama after all. And I wondered if you considered making it a courtroom drama at any point.
No, I had never considered making this a courtroom drama. I like courtroom dramas. I really do. I mean, I loved writing Midwives. I had a great time writing Midwives. But this is one of two books that I wrote when I started it knowing the first and the last sentence. Mm. The other example is The Double Bind. And so I knew point A and I knew point Z. And I knew I wanted to get to point Z. And I didn't think I was going to get there via the courtroom. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to get there in some other fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not at all a disappointment that it's not a courtroom drama.
Thank you.
But I was wondering at a certain point if it would become one.
I need to write another one.
Midwives, and also was The Law of Similars also a courtroom
No, believe
drama?
It or not, the only courtroom drama I've written is Midwives.
Oh, it is.
And the only reason it surprises people is because there are so friggin' many lawyers in my books. I mean, before you know, Kindness is 8 lawyers. The Law of Similars, narrated by a lawyer. Water Witches, narrated by a lawyer. The Double Bind, one of the main characters, narrators, is of course a lawyer.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm clearly a closet litigator.
So is Stephen. At one point in the book, somebody tells him he should have been a lawyer instead of a minister, right?
He does, yeah. No, Stephen is a very autobiographic character.
Oh, is he?
He is.
Oh, that's interesting.
He is, yeah. No, I'm not a minister, didn't sleep with a parishioner, but so much of Stephen's childhood is my childhood.
Well, sure, yeah.
Everything from his sort of obsession with the crucifixion to his conversations at college with people who are trying to recruit him into religious fellowships, when he says to them, you know, "Sure, I'll come with you, but you need to explain to me first Auschwitz, Biafra, childhood cancer." There's a lot of me in Stephen Drew, and that opening section that I just read, that's me many Sunday mornings in the pew. I'm sitting in my pew, and I'm listening to, I'm sitting in my pew, and I'm about to go on a book tour that's going to involve 35 regional jets, and I'm going to be in 35 cities, and I'm going to be gone for 5 weeks, and somebody is asking for traveling mercies because she's got a 90-minute drive to Rutland. And I'm just thinking, come on, life is too short for this.
Oh, that's good. You mentioned a minute ago the crucifixion obsession that Stephen Drew had as a child, and apparently you did too. I thought it was very interesting that both Stephen and Catherine have a sort of fixation on violence as children. And I liked that you gave them that in common because they are not... They're
antagonists.
They're antagonists in the book.
Sure.
And that makes
them
more complicated and interesting, I think, that they have that in common.
You know, I must confess, I hadn't realized they do have that in common, but you're absolutely right.
Okay.
I think that's a nice design element in the book, and I wish I could say it was conscious. But it wasn't conscious, but I think you're onto something. And maybe on some level this gets at that notion that we do have much more in common than we like to admit. And Catherine and Stephen have a greater connection than certainly they would ever admit.
Well, they both went in such different directions, and it ended up being very interesting. Sprinkled throughout Secrets of Eden are the excerpts from Heather Lorentz's books that you've mentioned. Did you envision using those from the start, or did that happen after you'd already gotten into the book?
The excerpts from Heather Lorentz's books happened after the book was underway.
Okay.
I have all of these references to Heather being a writer and an author, and the whole reason why Heather is even near this New England village when this tragedy occurs is because she's on a book tour. And so I thought that readers deserve to get a sense of what she writes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to write some passages from her two best-selling books, her first bestseller, Angels and/or Escapes, and her wildly successful follow-up, A Sacred While.
I love this excerpt from A Sacred While at the very end, like the penultimate section of the book before the last chapter. She says, although my faith in heaven is unshakable, although I am confident in the angels that reside amongst us, I am as filled with sorrows at endings as you are. What a lovely way to lead into the last chapter of the book. I thought that was great.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, did you write more than you included?
I did write more than I included.
Yeah.
Yes, there are other passages that I wrote for both A Sacred While and Angels and/or Escape that I did not include in the book. I did not include... The ones I included in the book do one of two things. They either foreshadow something that's going to occur in the next chapter, mm-hmm. in exactly the way that passage you read felt to you like a very nice entry into the last chapter,
mm-hmm.
or they move the plot forward. We learn a bit about Heather's childhood from them, but we also see what other people see in Heather.
Mm-hmm.
And that affects, I think, how we think of Heather. Somebody who's already read the book said to me, I gotta tell you, Heather Lorentz is a much better writer than you are. And I liked that. I mean, I like that. I want Heather to be smart. I like Heather a lot. She's one of my favorite female characters. She just happens to believe in angels.
Right. Now, you're going to get a lot of emails about angels now, right?
I probably am. But you know what's terrifying? I'm going to get a lot more, I think, about domestic abuse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just as I heard from women who were attacked after the double bind was published, I will hear from survivors of domestic abuse after Secrets of Eden
mm-hmm.
is published. But you are onto something. Here's a fun fact to amaze and dazzle your friends. More people in this country believe in angels than in evolution.
Okay.
Good to know.
That is good to know. What will you say when people at readings ask you if you believe in angels? Have you figured out what you'll say yet?
You know, I think we all want to believe there's a guardian out there looking out for us. Guardians plural. We all like to believe that there's someone who's going to pull us out of the way of the oncoming car at the last possible second. I don't necessarily believe in sentient creatures with wings, but I've not given up completely on the idea that maybe there's something that, for lack of a better term, we call an angel out there.
Mm-hmm. Katie Hayward is a high school student, your final narrator in the book. Was it difficult for you to write from the point of view of a teenage girl? Now, I know you have a teenage daughter.
It's like, not so bad. I do have a teenage daughter, and actually I've dedicated books to my daughter, so my daughter's name has appeared in the dedication page, but this is the first book where my daughter's name appears in the acknowledgments as one of my early readers. She read the first draft of this book for me in the same way that my wife always does, and she took it apart with a pen and deconstructed it and told me what, in her opinion, was authentic and what was inauthentic, and was really very, very helpful.
Well, that's great.
She's a good reader.
Did she have more to say about Katie than other characters, or did she...
She did have more to say about Katie than other characters. You're absolutely correct. Both how Katie speaks, so Katie doesn't sound too old, but also she didn't want Katie to be some sort of Mad TV or Saturday Night Live caricature of a 15-year-old. And in that regard, she was great in helping me to balance being 15 and being real.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. You must have been sort of proud at the same time.
I'm always proud of my family. I'm always proud of my wife and my daughter.
That's great. Your wife, we should mention, is Victoria Bleuer, the artist, and she works in photography and...
She hand paints photographs.
Hand paints.
She takes infrared black and white photographs, and then she prints them and tones them and hand colors them with these incredibly tiny paintbrushes she makes by hand, because no paintbrush exists that is fine enough for the work she needs to do on a print.
Wow. You did an interesting thing a couple of times within Katie's pages. Toward the end of the book, she describes a video of her parents dancing at a wedding that she was too young to attend. But the video to Katie is sort of, it serves as evidence that her parents were happy at one time. And in that way, it allows her to have an opinion and offers us her perspective that Alice and George were probably happy at one time. And I liked the video as a device, I guess, something to help her present that opinion. And then in the next chapter, when you do something similar where she imagines what might have happened the night her parents died. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, but her imagining this whole evening is such a natural thing after that video. We're right along with her because it just feels like she is entitled to tell us what she imagines. She knows them that well, and she can tell us. And the scene is very real, even though we know, okay, this isn't necessarily what happened, but it's what she thinks might have happened. Okay. Yeah, so that was fun to read.
Thank you.
It was fun to see how that all worked.
Thank you. I liked writing that video scene. I liked thinking that Alice once had been happy. Because I like Alice. Even though Alice doesn't have nearly as much time talking to us as the four living narrators, I'm glad that she was happy once.
Mm-hmm. It was also a pleasure to see how real Katie was in relaying how she felt about her father. There's all this obviously natural anger there, but there's also, she gives him a little bit of a break every once in a while, and that made it more real, I thought. I think an interesting complication is the fact that Stephen's personality is sometimes described as cold. He's a minister. You imagine that he's going to be warm and attentive with his congregants. And I think to some extent he is. They find that he ministers to them well. But
yeah, I mean, he's... Stephen refers to himself as being kind of icy. And certainly Catherine Benincasa thinks he's cold as ice. But there is the part of Stephen who ministers to the dying well. There is this part of Stephen who's terrific with the kids in the youth group. Mm-hmm. We see that. We see him praying with older parishioners. But he is kind of a lone wolf in his own way. He's quite content living alone. There are not a lot of 38-year-old Baptist ministers who are single. The reality is you usually need a spouse, a partner, a significant other to help with the heavy lifting of running a church. But he's quite content to live alone and to eat dinner with parishioners or to eat the occasional microwaved macaroni and cheese. Some of the scenes in the book that were really quite fun to write were Stephen's ruminations on living alone in the parsonage and how weirdly pathetic it was. and how he was always a little ashamed when he had a woman over with whom he had some romantic interest, because she would see that, what a weird, pathetic, lonely guy life I really lead. But as far as the parishioner is concerned, you know, he's Pastor Stephen.
Right. Right.
My favorite line in the book, and I think this really gets at what I was trying to do with the four narrators, is when Stephen Drew tells us toward the very end of his section, believe no one, trust no one, assume all of our stories are suspect. And I almost called the book All of Our Stories Are Suspect.
Mm.
Of course, that would have been a really bad title.
No, it would have been a really long title.
Yeah. True.
Yeah, I love that line. You're right. That's a great line. I need to go back and read Stephen again. You know, I hadn't done that after I read the whole book, and it would be interesting to read his whole section again, because he is unreliable, as you say, and just to see what he says and balancing all of that. Do you think that most people hold ministers to a higher standard because of their job? That's my question number one. And should they?
We absolutely hold ministers, rabbis, priests to a higher standard. And yes, we absolutely should. We absolutely should. The irony, of course, and when I was talking to ministers and rabbis when I was researching this book, is that they would always remind me, yeah, I'm human too.
Right.
And they understand well that they are held to this higher standard, and they don't want to let down their congregations, but they all have got friends who are ministers and rabbis who have made egregious but human mistakes. I heard about ministers who've had affairs with parishioners. Alcoholism.
In your interviews.
In my interviews, mm-hmm. Yeah. In my interviews. Alcoholism, affairs, and deeply wounding crises of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Where you just really hear you're supposed to be, the leader of a congregation, and you find yourself having doubts that are pretty serious.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting that he became romantically involved with Heather, because their belief systems are so different, or seemingly so. And I thought that was a fairly open-minded thing of Stephen to open his mind to her belief system. Was that...
Well, how much Stephen has opened his mind to Heather, I think, is the subject of an interesting English paper. I mean, I think Stephen sees a lot in Heather, but I don't think he is ever particularly sold on her belief in angels. They have some conversations about it, and he even says to her, and it's interesting, they are on such a different celestial plane when it comes to angels, that at one point when she's talking to him about angels, and he's immediately thinking about people who behave angelically, because his mind doesn't even go to the notion that no, she means creatures with wings that are flapping. And I just found that really interesting in their conversation.
Yeah. When we spoke last time, you mentioned F. Scott Fitzgerald having said that writers tend to have in common a sense of otherness,
okay,
and feeling like perhaps outsiders. Can you talk about that a tiny bit more?
Sure. One of the things that Fitzgerald talked about, and it might have been in the Crack Up, it might have been in some of his essays he wrote in the 1930s, is this sense that writers are often observers first. Mm-hmm. And they're observers because they're not part of something. I think one of the examples he used is he was always that kid with the fingers pressed up against the glass looking in at the party. One of the most poignant stories Fitzgerald ever told him about himself. It's 1920. He's now married to Zelda Fitzgerald. He's 24 years old. This Side of Paradise is a runaway bestseller. He and Zelda are staying at the Plaza in Manhattan. And all of a sudden, he's weeping. He's weeping uncontrollably. And he realizes he will never again be as happy as he is at that moment. Whether he lives 70 years, 90 years, 100 years, he will never again be that happy. And I think it's sort of a classic example of the way writers tend not to live in the moment, but to live a few minutes after the moment, already looking back on it and deconstructing what occurred and what it meant.
And taking notes.
And taking notes, yeah. Yeah. One of the things I love about digital technology is how easy it is for me, whether I'm at the gym, whether I'm in the car, and I always pull over in the car, on an airplane, in safe mode, to immediately just send an email to myself with something I want to put into a novel, or something I don't want to forget. I'm writing a book right now in which aviation figures prominently, and I can't tell you how many descriptions of clouds I've written at 35,000 feet right into my BlackBerry, or now my iPhone, and just sent it to myself to put right into the manuscript.
Yeah, things are changing fast. Yeah. My last question for writers usually has to do with writer's block, but since I interviewed you once before, and we did cover that territory, this time I was wondering if you might offer advice for first-time writers who hope to publish.
Go to Hollywood. Steer clear of the novel. Avoid the short story. God knows, don't go anywhere near a newspaper. I have no idea what newspapers, magazines, novels, short stories are going to look like in the next generation. I mean, obviously I'm being glib. I don't think it's all that dire.
I hope not.
No. But the reality is that how we read is changing dramatically.
Right.
It's changing quickly. I think it's moving much more quickly than anyone anticipated 2 years ago or 10 years ago. So my advice to people who want to get published is this. First of all, don't be afraid of rejection. I amassed 250 rejection slips before I ever sold a single word. Secondly, write in the genre you love. If you like romance novels, write romance novels. If you like literary fiction, write literary fiction. But don't try to be something you're not because you think it's more commercially saleable. No good comes from trying to be the kind of writer you're not. And I hear all the time these stories of really talented writers who are trying to write a book that they don't care about. And it never works. It never works.
Because of a trend or...
They're trying to jump on a trend. You know, they're trying to write about vampires, or they're trying to write about serial killers, or they're trying to write about papal killers. And it just never works, because your heart's got to be in it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to spend 2 years on a novel, you really have to care passionately about what you're doing. So that would be my advice. Have a thick skin. Write what you love. Oh, and I'll add a third thing. If you can, if your day job allows it, write every day. Somebody once asked John Updike, how in the world did you write 65 books? And he smiled and shrugged and said, 2 pages a day. It's a marathon. It is not a sprint.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for talking with me.
Shayla, it's always a pleasure. This is a great show, and I always have a great time. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Chris Bojalian. Next week, tune in to hear an interview with Janet Reed, an agent with Fine Print Literary Management in New York and writer of 2 blogs, one of which is Query Shark, on which query letters by brave writers are posted and critiqued, sometimes without mercy. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Chris Bojalian. As we discussed in the interview, Chris allowed one of his narrators, Katie Hayward, to have a point of view about something she hadn't actually witnessed. That is, her parents having danced lovingly at a wedding. Katie relays details about this moment by way of a home movie that she has seen of the dance. This week, experiment with unusual ways to let your characters narrate events they may not have first-hand knowledge of. Let a father find a note that his daughter wrote to her boyfriend. Let the detective overhear a conversation in the washroom. give that philandering husband a frightening and possibly prophetic dream. Or, as Chris did, share an event with your narrator by way of a reasonably reliable video recording. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com, and Write the Book is also on Twitter. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.